I'm Santori Lee Jones, and we will be discussing Babylon's Banksters, the Alchemy of Deep Physics, High Finance, and Ancient Religion with our guest, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Sancho. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I got to tell you, it's our pleasure. Our chat room, we do an interactive show on the show between the SHTF411.com chat room and, of course, on here. And what they do is they put their questions on the chat, and then I ask away. But they're stoked tonight. So what I'd like to hear first is, because you've written on a myriad of topics extensively on some very deep topics. Can you just give us a brief overview? I mean, you went to Oxford. How did you get interested in this type of stuff?
Well, I've always been that's a good question, but I've always been interested in this kind of stuff. And, you know, Oxford is a very, very different it's a very different experience than anything in the American academic experience. And one thing that people have to realize about the history of the place is that it's always had its kind of eccentric academics, I guess is the best way of putting it. You know, people like Alexander Thome and his researches into the megalithic yard, and certainly Sir Isaac Newton, you know, being not only a scientist but an alchemist, and his associations with the place. So, you know, it's a place that, in a certain sense, kind of cultivates strangeness. I don't know how else to put it. But personally, you know, I've always been interested and had this interest all my life. And when I quit college teaching, I just decided I might as well bite the bullet and start writing down some of my strange ideas.
Hey, I love them. They're great ideas. I don't even think they're ideas. When I was hunting I think everyone, to a degree, we all have our own perceptions and we make our own reality. And I got to say, from looking at your work, I agree with your outlook on things.
Well, thank
really
you. It's been an interesting experience, needless to say, writing about these things.
So on to the book. This is actually the Babylon's Banksters, the Alchemy of Deep Physics, High Finance, and Ancient Religion, is actually a follow up to two predecessors, correct?
Right. I have basically two arches in my series of books, and the thing I should point out, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with my works, but all of my works are conceived very intentionally to dovetail into each other, and they're kind of laid out in a prearranged sequence, but there's two basic series to them. There's a series that deals with ancient history and the interface of some very abstruse notions in physics with that history. And then the other series is a series that deals almost exclusively with Nazi Germany and some of the very strange technologies that they were coming up with, because in fact the two stories are intimately related. But in the ancient series, yes, you're quite correct. Babylon's Banksters was intended as a sequel in an arch of books that I'm planning, and I'm writing one currently right now, as a matter of fact, that's in that arch of books that follow on a book of mine called The Cosmic War. That lays out basically what it says. It lays out the scenario from ancient texts that there was an interplanetary war fought in our solar system, and that certain elites of that conflict survived that war and began to rebuild. And I've been following that story in some of my books, The Philosopher's Stone. I've got one coming out now called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men that'll be out in a couple of months that continues that story. And again, like I say, a book I'm writing right now. Well, Babylon's Banksters kind of falls into that sequence of books.
I feel like getting a copy of every single one of your books and going into my local bank and hand them out.
Well, I won't object to that, certainly. If you do order my books, do so off of my website. I get a little bit more from the royalty if people order them directly off my website. You know, I'm a starving author, so I have to beg and plead for all the pennies I can get.
Now, real quick, your website is thegisadeathstar.com,
no,
correct?
No, it's just www.gisadeathstar.com. GizaDestar, GizaDestar.com, and it's all one word, all lowercase.
Okay, well, so the people know now. So can you give us a little, how do these, because, I mean, Babylon, you're tying the modern banking system into Babylon and by further extension into this cosmic war.
Yes.
What are these? I mean, I have to ask right off the top of my head, what are these people? Are they people? Are they, or what? I mean, are they ETs? Are they extraterrestrials? Or are they the spawn of, you know, that was a creation?
Well, a good question, and let's begin at the beginning. If you have read Cosmic War, and more importantly, some of the other books dealing with ancient technology that I've written, you'll discover, of course, that many of the ancient texts hint at or indicate that there may have been some sort of genetic tinkering that went on in very, very ancient times that helped engineer the human species into existence. Now, I do not make that a component of my analysis in Babylon's Banksters at all. In fact, I kind of leave that question open for the later book in the series, and I'll probably write more about that subject anyway. But what I'm dealing with in Babylon's Banksters is really two philosophies of the creation of money, and the first philosophy being that earliest philosophy that you see in the ancient records is that states or nations had the idea that money creation was the prerogative of the state itself. In other words, money was issued debt-free as a receipt on the surpluses of the state warehouse. And putting that into modern terms, money then would be a receipt on the goods and services against a gross domestic product, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, this philosophy that our founding fathers had, the philosophy that Abraham Lincoln pursued in the Civil War, the philosophy that President Kennedy was moving back to toward the end of his first administration, this philosophy of the creation of money is actually very, very old. It's millennia old. And what you see happen in ancient history is the emergence of what I would like to call, you know, banksters, essentially what we have today. You have an international class of people that attach themselves to the temples in ancient societies. And the reason for that is that temples were more or less the mechanism by which the state issued its money. So this bankster class attached itself to the temples, to religion, to give the sanctity and probity of religion to what they were doing. And what they were doing, essentially, is what modern bankers have done, and that is to extend and eventually gain a monopoly over the issuance of a nation's currency or its money as debt, as monetized debt. So in other words, you still have in ancient times, beginning in ancient times, you have a conflict between sovereign nations trying to retain control over their own money issuance and a private international banking class, for want of a better expression, that is attempting to usurp that monopoly, to privatize it in their own hands, and issue what I call the facsimile of money, which is monetized debt.
Right, right. Our current system, the current system in the United States of America.
Yes, exactly, exactly. It's exactly that. And it's important, you know, what I'm trying to get at and wake people up to in Babylon's Banksters is that this is a very, very old, old game. And the tactics of the banksters, when you study what they did in ancient times, in all these millennia, they really have not changed at all. Because in order to gain this control over the money supply and issuance of the various nations that they were embroiled with, one of the things they did was, of course, whenever the nation's currency, whatever it happened to be, came into their hands, they'd simply remove it from circulation. So, you know, the game goes on. The tactics haven't changed at all. They're very old.
Now, these people, now, to clarify that, you're saying that the fiat money system is not, you know, almost 100 years old. You're saying that it is literally thousands of years old. Do you believe
that is part of
the esoteric information?
Well, yes, in a certain sense it is, because what you're dealing with are two forms of alchemy, and this is the reason I subtitled the book The Alchemy of High Finance, Deep Physics, and Ancient Religion, because alchemy is based on a physics, and I get into this quite extensively in my book called The Philosopher's Stone, but it's based on the ancient view that the physical medium was an information-creating medium. So money, if you look at it from this ancient point of view, with that kind of physics conception in mind, money itself is an alchemical act. If it is the issuance of a nation state, it's the creation of information against something real that exists and that has value, namely the surplus goods and services of a state warehouse. On the other hand, what the bankster class is practicing is kind of a form of black alchemy, because what they're creating is negative information, if you will. And I like to illustrate that by pointing out that when a bank puts money into circulation, it can only do so by loaning it into circulation. And this is a crucial point. Only a state issues money into circulation debt-free. Banks can only loan money into circulation, and as a result of that, banks do not create the money in circulation to pay the interest on the debt that they're circulating as money. All right? So in other words, anytime you have that kind of system of monetized debt as the basis of currency, you are never, ever going to get out of a situation of national debt, for the very simple reason that the interest on the principal is never in circulation. It's never part of the creation of the money supply. So you're dealing always with a kind of a huge Ponzi scheme, you know, where somebody is always going to be on the short end of the stick.
So to clarify, and I'll put it in a question format, how is it possible in this type of system, which is globally right now, I believe, how is it possible to repay the debt with interest? I mean, how is it possible to repay anything?
It ultimately isn't. All you do is you keep getting further and further into debt. Now, the system isn't completely global, because it's important to note that China issues its own currency debt-free. The renminbi, the yuan, is issued debt-free. It's people's currency. So in other words, the Chinese system of money itself is basically that system of money that our founding fathers intended. It was the system of money that, incidentally, Adolf Hitler put into place in Nazi Germany when he took power. It's the system of money that Abraham Lincoln followed to finance the Civil War, and it was the system of money that John Fitzgerald Kennedy was moving back to toward the end of his first administration. So, yeah, if that doesn't tell you something right away.
Yeah, I'm following a trend. You know,
you're following a trend here, yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, right before I did 30 minutes of current events, and one of the current events was there's a new video game. Of course, there's a new movie, The New Red Dawn, and the new video game, Homefront. And both of them have the evil, North Korea enemy via China. It's funny that you make that. Yeah, it seems like the trend is following suit. So please continue.
I don't necessarily think China is an economic enemy, because for one thing, you know, they depend quite a bit on American trade, so it's not in their interest to invade or crash the economy or anything like that. But I do think, and I've said this on many other shows, I've said it on numerous occasions. Pardon me. I do think that what you are looking at right now, pardon me, you're looking at the Anglo-American banking and corporate elite on a huge global defensive. And the reason for that is that their shell game and their, you know, their basis of power, trying to push around everybody else in the world, is quickly coming to an end. You're seeing massive political realignments in Asia between China and India and Japan and Russia. The last Japanese elections, when they kicked out the ruling party in that country that's basically been running things ever since the war, they kicked that party out of power. And then you see the Japanese Emperor Akihito making a state visit to Beijing. That's kind of a little signal right there, folks.
Absolutely.
That, that this corporate elite that's been running things in London and New York and in Great Britain and the United States, it's definitely on the economic defensive, I believe.
Now, you're touching on some points that I was wanting to get into. You actually got me excited there. Because I want to see how this thing unfolds in the modern day. But to give us some background, the system we have now in the United States, the Federal Reserve, the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, are those, for the time being, or were they poised as the manipulators or controllers of the world? And did those come from, say, the Rothschilds? I mean, can you give us some background on the power structure of the world? Because this really does boil down into literally like shadow empires to a degree.
Yes, 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 it does. The IMF and the World Bank are there's another component of this international financial Ponzi scheme that it's very important to take into consideration, and that's an institution called the Bank of International Settlements that is based in Switzerland. This bank was the brainchild of the interwar bankers in London and New York, but there's another banker involved in this, and that was Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, who eventually becomes Hitler's banker. All right. In fact, that bank was in particular his brainchild. All right, and it was set up to handle the transfer of payments between the Western powers and Germany in the interwar period, and since that time, it's mushroomed to something much, much larger. So you've got the IMF, you've got the World Monetary Fund, and you've got the Bank of International Settlements. But yes, these things are all essentially the creations of the London and New York bankers. And certainly, when you say that, you've said Rothschild, Rockefeller, Kuhn-Loeb, and that whole Morgan, that whole nexus of very, very rich super bankers.
Were there other? I mean, you mentioned the nation states in history have tried to fight against this. Are there? And you mentioned the Chinese in today's day and age actually playing almost a game of chess with the New York bankers. What are some of the other power structures that have been out there? I mean, are there other structures that have been out there, or are they just almost new upstarts?
Oh yes, I think there are. Definitely are other power structures out there, and one of them, and this is, this is the curveball and the bad news, okay? This is a part of the story that comes from the Nazi series of books I've written. I've written a book called The Nazi International, in which I make the case or argue the case that Nazism survived the war, all right, and that's not news. Everybody knows it did. But what I'm saying is that it survived the war in more or less a coherent extraterritorial organized structure. It's kind of an extraterritorial state unto itself, all right? Mm-hmm. Now let's look at something that I mentioned at the very beginning of Babylon's Banksters, and that is that if you look very carefully at the purposes and reasons behind the founding of the Bilderberger Group, what you're really looking at is a coordination or a detente of sorts that is struck between the Anglo-American banking faction on the one hand and this Nazi international, if you want to call it that, on the other. Because look who the founders of the Bilderbergs are. On the one hand, on the Anglo-American side, you certainly have the involvement of the Rockefeller family, of the Rothschild family, in setting this up. But on the European side, who do you have? You have Prince Bernhard. What's Prince Bernhard? Well, he's an SS officer. He was in senior management of IG Farben, okay? And one of the early and most regular participants on the European side of the Bilderberg meetings was none other than Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who was, of course, the CEO of Deutsche Bank, all right? So in other words, what I'm suggesting is that if you recall that the Nazis make it out of Europe with just an enormous haul of loot, all right, in almost every conceivable form, liquid cash assets, hard assets like gold and platinum, bullion, diamonds, you name it, they had it, and they had it in just heaps and mounds of treasure. But all of that had to be laundered somehow. And I strongly suspect that the purpose of the Bilderberg Group meetings was precisely to move all of this Nazi loot into these Western banking houses in London and New York. And as a result of this, these banks could keep that as an off-the-books reserve, expand their ledger credit-making entry ability. In other words, they could lend money on the basis of that reserve into circulation, and then in turn that money gets funneled back to Europe as part of the European rebuilding plan, and the bankers of course take their cut. So in other words, I think what you're looking at with the Bilderberg Group in its early phases, in its early stages, is simply the establishment of a group that coordinates this vast transfer of money from this Nazi international into the Western banks and then back to Europe. All right. So in other words, it's you're looking at two factions, two very large underground factions involved. Now, here's the bad news, and I've said this many times in other interviews. The head of all of this, of course, is a lovely, wonderful man by the name of Martin Bormann, all right? Mm-hmm. And I do argue the case in the Nazi International that Bormann makes it out of Germany alive and well, all right? Now, it's important for people to understand that Martin Bormann is truly a financial genius. I mean, we're dealing here, and I like to say this, and I've said it many times, when we're thinking of Martin Bormann, people have to think of Dick Cheney, but without the warmth and charm.
Oh!
Okay? So, you know, when these Anglo-American bankers get all of this money from this Nazi international, they have to understand that they are dealing with an organization and with a man that is going to put a very high price tag. And when those markers come due someday, as they inevitably will, these people that they're dealing with have the means, if they aren't willing to pay up, to take them out. So this is the bad part of the story. I think, in all honesty, this is kind of a gut intuition, but I think in all honesty that part of this current financial meltdown that we're seeing right now is the reemergence of factional infighting, at least between these two groups.
Now, that's incredible. That spurs so many questions, and the top off the top of my head is Dick Cheney and are the Bushes, are they part of this Nazi International, or would they be grouped with the American Anglo bankers?
Well, you know, there's been a lot written about both Cheney and the Bush family. My gut intuition is that they are squarely in the camp of the Anglo-American financial faction. However, most people that know anything about the history of the financial dealings of the Bush family, Prescott Bush and his dealings with Fritz Thiessen, and the German angle is all tied in there. So yeah, you know, they're standing somewhere in between the two as kind of liaisons, I would think, between the two groups.
Now, I agree with that fully. My question that's leading up to that, so you're actually right now under the belief that the American Anglo bankers, for all intents and purposes, are being taken out?
I wouldn't say necessarily being taken out. There are people out there on the internet arguing this right now. I do say, and I do think, that they're showing certain signs of being under assault. They're showing certain signs of being under duress and under pressure from somewhere. And in my reading of the historical record, there's only a very few places that can put that kind of extreme financial pressure on these people. And the first thing historically in the record is this Nazi International. The other things that are in the record as having that kind of financial clout would certainly be, of course, China, because they're not beholden to these bankers to begin with. And the other thing that has to be noted is if you look at Europe right now, the country that is suffering the least from the current financial problems is, of course, Germany. And they are very, very tight with communist China and with Russia and some of the economic policies that those nations are pursuing. So, yeah, I think, you know, we have to look not only to the possibility that this Nazi international fascist organization is putting extreme pressure on that Anglo-American financial faction, but we also have to look at some other geopolitical players, and at the top of the list, I would certainly include Russia. I would certainly include China.
Now, you just accidentally said what I was going to ask you about. Now, when I think of Russia, I uh-huh. don't just think Russia. I think Greek also, because I mean, you do have the Greek Orthodox. I'm thinking churches here, but
yes.
I'm also thinking power structures of old times. Where do they fit in? I mean, are they a dual team there, the Greeks and the Russians, and how do they fit into this? Not so much the Greeks, but the Russians.
Well, the Russians, it's very interesting that you ask that question, because I happen, by sort of personal connection and past affiliations, I happen to have, you know, Eastern Orthodox leanings, and I was certainly involved in that church for many, many years. I'm kind of retired from the ecclesiastical scene, but if I were active in it, you know, that I would once again be active in Eastern Orthodoxy. So you're entirely correct that this plays a big part in the Russian mentality and the Russian culture, because they are not part of the cultural development of the West, because Orthodoxy developed very, very differently than did Western Christianity. In fact, I like to tell people, and this usually gets completely missed, but when you think of Orthodoxy, you literally have to jettison everything that you think you know about Christianity. It may look Catholic in a very strange way, but it thinks entirely differently than any form of Western Christianity altogether. When you look at modern Russia, and particularly the policies of the Russian government since Vladimir Putin took control and then his protege Medvedev, and if you look at the symbols that the Russian government has adopted, you know, they've returned to the use of and display of the Romanov eagle and so on and so forth as part of the symbolism of the country. If you look at Putin's policies, he's often decried in the West as being kind of another Stalin, all right? But this is entirely untrue. What Putin really is a classic Russian nationalist. And
I'd agree.
The Russians know very good and well the financial group that put the communists into power in the first place. So Putin, if you look at his moves on the international stage, he's not only a Russian nationalist, but he's making subtle moves to remove as much of that Anglo-American corporate influence over Russian affairs as he can possibly do. And I think this is the reason you see Russia not only in an attempt to realign itself with continental Europe, and in particular with Germany, but I think this is also the reason that you see Russia's realignments and recent financial policies with China, you know, dropping the dollar as the basis of their international trade between the two countries. I think this is the reason you see Russia pushing very strongly for mutual developments in space with China and India and so on and so forth. And I also think clearly that this is the reason that you see Russia putting military bases in Venezuela. The Russians are clearly signaling that they are just not going to sit by and play the game as it's being dictated by London and New York.
We're almost at the top of the hour now.
Uh-huh.
For the listeners out there, we're going to take a break at the top of the hour and at the half hour. So do you want to go ahead and take a break now, Dr. Farrell?
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. I'll need to take a break, and I'll be right back.
Okay, we'll see you in a couple minutes, and
all
thanks for being on. All right.
Uh-huh.
All right, folks, he'll be right back. We are going to continue on with current events. So right into the mix. earlier I was talking about the inflation of both the United States and New Zealand. It's happening all around the world, and I gave my 2 cents on it. I say it's happening all over the world. I think that actually China and Russia are not suffering that much, but that's just my opinion. I believe that this is a New World Order push by those, as Dr. Farrell phrased it, the Anglo-American banksters, to keep their serfs, that would be you and I, we the people, their serfs, in line. So, you know, McDonald's is saying that they're going to raise their prices 2 to 2.5% in the States and 4 to 4.5% in Europe. However, as Loping Level pointed out, it's 30%. Alex VH also pointed that same thing out in his thread, New Zealand's inflation 5.3% to 5.9%. He's saying that it apparently is a lot more than that. So it's up to y'all what y'all believe. On that note, I wanted to cover one story that is kind of interesting. It's dealing with food. I know a lot of y'all are getting used to the idea of medical marijuana. Well, a man came out with – this man did not – I don't have his name, but it's in the thread, medical marijuana users getting pot soft drink. This is posted by Stephen Mills, 35. The product is called Canna Cola. It's a soft drink that contains THC, which is the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. It's being aimed and marketed toward the medical marijuana dispensaries. I don't think I'd touch this cola just because I think if I was going to do something like that, I would just go ahead and actually smoke the regular herb. I could see you actually overdosing on THC using a product like that. But yeah, each their own. Coincidentally, the producer of that product does not use it himself. He does not do any drugs. In fact, he does not drink beer. He's never smoked pot. He's actually a graphic design artist. So I don't know if he's the person funding the project or if he's the person doing the design work. I don't know how much of a shoestring budget it is. It's a little out of my league. I know I won't do it, but hey, each their own. So if you decide that you want to, instead of smoke marijuana medically, if you decide you want to have a can of Canna Cola, then more power to you. So we'll be right back with our guest. In fact, I believe he is about ready to come back on the air. So I'm going to.
I'm here.
Go ahead.
I'm here.
Hello, doctor.
Hello.
So what do you think of the Canna Cola? I assume you heard that then.
I heard portions of it, and you know, my political philosophy is essentially libertarian. I don't see that it makes much sense for any government to prohibit the use of something that grows as a plant.
You know? Absolutely. Yeah. So we were discussing the Russians and Orthodoxy, the Orthodox
uh-huh.
Church.
Uh-huh.
You really started hitting on that Orthodox Church, and I made the connection
uh-huh.
between the Greeks and the Russians. Is there
uh-huh.
is that a connection? Are they one group of power players?
Well, Orthodoxy is it's important for people with a Western Christian background to understand that Orthodoxy is about the only analog that it has in the Western Christian experience would be the Anglican Communion. In other words, you know, Episcopalians. Because within Orthodoxy, each national church has its own independent hierarchy. What unites Orthodoxy is a commonality of doctrine and belief. But there is no pope figure in Orthodoxy. So in other words, you know, the Patriarch of Moscow does not speak for the Greek church, nor does the Greek church speak for the Patriarchate of Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
They are independent, completely independent hierarchies, but they're all in communion with each other, just like, you know, the worldwide Anglican Communion is all in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. So, yeah, it's a different sort of thing than people can think of in the West.
Well, the reason I was asking is because there's a lot of documentation showing the cohesion between the Catholic Church and the Nazis, let's say, with
yes.
funneling of money and stuff. And I was just curious, I mean, are these Orthodox churches, are they literally the other power group? I mean, are they the representation of Russia and some of these other countries, or is it, or do you believe they're two separate things?
Well, again, it's a very complicated question because, in a certain sense, your question is being framed from a Western background. And again, like
sure.
I say, when you move to Eastern Europe, when you move to the Orthodox cultures, you are dealing with something, with a culture that is formed by a completely different understanding of fundamental doctrines of Christianity. Very, very different. Every doctrine in Orthodoxy is different than the Western expression of it. In other words, even the doctrine of the Trinity is different in Orthodoxy. The doctrine of ancestral sin as opposed to original sin in the West, that's different. So everything becomes different, and you have to understand that the Orthodox culture is therefore different in its mentality and outlook than is the Western culture that basically comes as a development of things within Western Christianity. So I would have to say that if you look at Putin, for example, Putin is a practicing Russian Orthodox Christian, and the Western mentality would be to look at that and say, well, this is just a politician trying to use God, or to pimp God, so to speak, as a means of furthering his political power and agenda. But this is not the case, because Orthodoxy is so deeply intertwined with the Russian national culture that, you know, not to embrace that religion is, to a certain extent, not to embrace your nationality. And the same thing holds true in Greece, of course, because Orthodoxy, again, is very, very much a part of Greek national culture, even for someone who is not terribly religious. It's very difficult to take yourself out of the cultural milieu that Orthodoxy has formed in Eastern Europe. So, you know, you have to look very carefully. It should be noted that when Premier Gorbachev was in charge of the end of the Soviet Union, that many of his top advisors were, in fact, Russian Orthodox hierarchs and clergymen. So even in the communist state, you had a very, very close sort of de facto working agreement or working alliance between the state and the church that is very, very hard for the Western mentality to comprehend.
Sure.
why you would have an officially atheistic state and yet in league with something that very obviously is not atheistic.
Sure, sure. So now that I enjoyed that. But back to our banks. How many factions? Because that's what I was really going towards. How many factions are there in the world that we're looking at? How many players are using, and are they all the descendants of these Babylonians or these literally space critters? I mean, are they all that, or are they rebelling nation states?
Well, that's an excellent question, and you know, to put an exact number on the factions that we see now, I certainly think you have to count at least two as private factions. You have to count the Anglo-American corporate interest as being one of them, certainly. You would have to count and factor into the equation this vast underground criminal international fascist organization or extraterritorial state, because that really is more or less what it is. Those would be at least two. But you add to this something that I think most people, at least in the West, are inclined to forget, and that is that you still have the classical geopolitical interests of the major powers in play. In other words, you certainly have to factor into this mix the geopolitical outlook and interests of China, of Japan, of Russia, of India. You know, these are all major players and emerging major players on the geopolitical and financial scene, and they're going to keep emerging. You know, the days of the Anglo-American corporate geopolitical monopoly influence over the affairs of the world is over, and it's ending rather quickly, in my opinion. But to put kind of an historical spin on your question, I think, again, if we go back to what I say in Babylon's Banksters, you have essentially two philosophies in competition with each other. namely the philosophy that says that nation states should have a major control and influence over the issuance of their currency versus a private monopoly interest. Now, one of the things I do not fill in, other than very briefly in a kind of a summary fashion in the book, is the story in the Middle Ages. But there is an outline, there is a hint of that story in the book, in that when the Roman Empire expands into Mesopotamia, it brings many of these Chaldean families from Mesopotamia into Rome as slaves. And the Roman practice is, of course, on the death of the slave owner, the Roman practice was quite common to free the slaves. And as a result of this, in the late empire, you see many of these freed slaves actually making it up into the upper echelons of the imperial bureaucracy and also becoming quite successful financially. And, of course, they by and large, are private bankers. These families, in turn, form the nucleus of the banking families and the private fondi of the great Italian banking families surrounding Venice and Genoa during the Renaissance. And from there, you find these families expanding in their financial relationships into the Holy Roman Empire, the Fuggers family in Germany, for example, during the Renaissance period, a very successful banking family. And from there, of course, they expand into the private bankers of Amsterdam. And from there, of course, during the English Glorious Revolution in the 17th century, across the English Channel, and eventually you find this same sort of long historical networked group eventually becoming the interest, the private financial interest behind the Bank of England. So, yeah, the story is very, very old. It's very, very deep. Tracing all the interconnections, you know, would require volumes, but it's definitely doable and it's definitely there.
That's incredible. Speaking of that, I mean, I've delved into this topic on my own, just an independent researcher, and it is complex.
Mm-hmm.
My question specifically is with the Rothschilds. Did they literally... It seems like they came out of nowhere. You know, the story is, oh, they just put the shield up and they're, you know, buying and selling, or, you know, coin traders, basically. Is that what really happened, or can you trace them back also?
Ah. Well, that's the $64 trillion question.
Yeah, it is.
Well, the public story, the official story of how that family accumulated its vast wealth and influence is more or less true, all right? But there is an aspect of the story that I mentioned very, very briefly in Babylon's Banksters. In the process of researching the book, I ran across a source that maintained without substantiation, all right, and I underline those words, underline them, boldface them, italicize them, without substantiation, okay, that the Rothschild family traced its origins, or claims to trace its origins, to Nimrod, all right?
That's interesting.
And it's very interesting. And, of course, you know, I didn't think much of it, and I thought, well, gee, that's interesting, but I certainly can't mention that without some sort of corroboration. All right. So in the process of trying to I eventually did mention it in the book, because in the process of trying to corroborate it, I found two very, very interesting things. The first is I did a Google search for the various investment groups that are sponsored by the Rothschild family, and I came up with one of them that is kind of a mutual fund investment group called the Nimrod Group, all right?
Huh.
And then I did a little further researching, and I found that there were actually some of the English branch of the family that were given the name Nimrod, all right?
Huh.
Now, you know, that literally stunned me, Sancho, because, you know, Nimrod is not exactly your standard Hebrew name, you know? It's not a standard name that you would find in any in any Jewish family. You know, I've had members of my family that were Jewish, and you know, they were as equally perplexed about that as I was.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an interesting thing, you know, that, you know, why would this family name some of its members after that particular notorious biblical character?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so let me ask you, you bring up Nimrod. What are the because you've investigated the astrological or the esoteric, the occult nature of this. Can you give us some insight? I know that's a broad topic, but I mean, I've been seeing some stuff online that they're talking stuff that I'm not very familiar with, that when I read it or I'm watching a YouTube video or something, I get mesmerized talking about blood sacrifices and
uh-huh.
these other things to boost up literal power, I guess, occult
uh-huh.
magic. How does all uh-huh. this play into this? I mean, it's nuts. It's nuts for me to even have to think of that when I'm, you know, Bank of America or Chase Manhattan. That, you know, even though they're robbing us blind, you still think that it's an established, legitimate business.
Oh, boy.
Deep topic, I know.
That is such a deep, deep, deep question. And I have, in fact, spoken directly to that question in some of my other interviews on other shows. But it is so deep, in fact, that I have never really publicly come out and said everything that there is to say on the topic, because it is so very, very dangerous. But
I hear you.
But in brief, this has to deal directly with how the ancients conceived of the physical medium itself. And if you read my books carefully, particularly a book called The Giza Death Star Destroyed, and then again my book The Philosopher's Stone, one of the things that I point out is that in the ancient mind, in the ancient conception of the physics of the physical medium itself, in other words, when I say physical medium, just think the fabric of space-time, in their thinking, that medium is itself the philosopher's stone. In other words, it transmutes itself. It creates information, all right? But they also had the view that consciousness was, so to speak, directly interfaced with that medium. So that if you want to rationalize on the basis of the ancient mentality, of the ancient conception of this physics, if you want to rationalize why blood sacrifices are practiced, part of the reason is that this is, in their thinking, a way to shock the medium, to gain power and influence and control over it, and to manipulate it for a certain goal or purpose. All right, and that is as brief as of an answer that I can give, because it is so extraordinarily complex and so extraordinarily intricately detailed with all of the other components of the ancient understanding of the physics of the medium and of the physics of consciousness. It's a very, very, very deep subject.
Mm. Well, I've got to tell you, it was something I recently stumbled upon, and as you said, the dangerous nature of the topic, it scared me to think, you know, I actually have contacted relatives with children, you know, you need to look into occult dates, and you need to make sure you know where your kids are at, because you just never know.
Well, there are, as I said, there are, I'm hoping to address that topic more directly in the book that I'm writing now, but there are certainly hints of the type of mentality and of the physics behind it in the books that I've already written. I doubt, to be very honest with you, Sancho, that I will ever fully publicly write about all the implications and details of this, because it is so very, very dangerous, and there are very, very few groups that really know the full details of it, but it is very, very dangerous. And again, I can say with some degree of certitude, say maybe 60-80% certainty, that activity constitutes one of the many activities of one of the elites that survived that cosmic war and has been active in the history of the world since that time. Because if you look at the spread of the practice, you find it certainly in the Middle East with some of those religions, you find it being practiced very, very early in Hindu cultures. You find it in, of course, Mesoamerica with the Mayans and the Aztecs. It's a practice that spreads, and it's a practice also that if you read carefully the justifications for it given in various religious and mythological texts are almost identical in each and every instance.
Hmm. It's mind-blowing. It really is. I understand. I mean, I look at your work, and it blows doors. It literally blows doors open. And I can understand reservation and not wanting to put yourself too far out there because it's scary. It's, you know, very scary. I want to ask you some other questions that mm-hmm. these are actually a list of questions from the shtf41.com mini chat. Uh-huh. I'm going to try and put them in some order. Some of them are going to be a little out of order, so please forgive me.
That's all
right. The first question is, what was President Andrew Jackson's relationship with the banksters? He had a famous quote when he died, so please.
Well, President Jackson, this is a little known aspect of American history for most people. But President Jackson, of course, came into office with the avowed intention. In fact, that he ran on the platform of doing away with the charter of the Bank of the United States. And the Bank of the United States was the kind of Federal Reserve at that time. All right, it was a private bank that had a monopoly over the issuance of the nation's currency. And Andrew Jackson, of course, spent his presidency, his administrations, battling the chairman of that bank, a fellow by the name of Nicholas Biddle, all right? And, of course, Biddle thought that he would win that contest, but he didn't. Jackson won it. And, of course, Jackson, for his efforts, you know, they attempted to assassinate the man. You know, surprise, surprise, where have we heard that before? But Jackson survived the attempt. And, you know, you've got to dig around for Jackson's veto message to Congress as to why he was vetoing the bill to charter the bank, to recharter the bank. But basically, Jackson said, and I believe I'm quoting him nearly exactly, he said, "You are a den of vipers."
Wow.
And I will root you out.
So, wow.
You know, he did not have a very high, you know, I don't have much love lost for President Jackson and the things that he did to the Cherokee and other Native American Indians by any stretch of the imagination. But on the other hand, you know, I have to applaud the man for what he saw was the danger in, you know, a private monopoly central bank controlling the currency supply of the United States. So, yeah, he, you know, Jackson's a key part of this story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next three questions are actually, you'll love this. It's you're going to be answering questions from a tamale. We know him as Tamale. So, the first question is, Dr. Farrell, given what you said about the way that economic and political power structures seem to be breaking down, do you think that this would result in a releasing or rediscovery of advanced physics and ensuing technologies?
Oh, wonderful question. Yes. I think if you read certain tea leaves that are going on, certain symbolic messages that are being sent by various people inside the institutional power structures of the West right now, there is clearly, in my opinion, a kind of a battle between the old guard and the young Turks. The young Turks in my opinion, seem to realize that the policies of that elite that have been in play more or less for the last 120, 130 years are the policies that have led to this mess, and they are simply going to have to allow some of this new physics, some of the technologies that are associated with it, out into the open. That said, I want to say something that I have said on other shows. I write a lot in my books about a kind of physics that truly, truly is breathtaking. And in particular, I write about it a lot in connection with my books that explore the Nazi angle, the Nazi technology associated with the Bell Project. And I've said all along that if you have a technology that gives you access to this type of physics, you can call it zero-point energy physics, you can call it scalar physics, you can call it torsion physics, I don't care what you want to call it, it's essentially the same stuff. This stuff can and indeed does lead you to a technology that would allow you a nearly inexhaustible energy supply. All right? But the flip side of that coin is that any time you say that you have a technology that allows you to engineer the fabric of space-time locally, if you weaponize that technology, you have a potential weapon capability that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. All right?
Wow.
And this means then for the elite that has been watching and guarding and keeping this sort of stuff off the books and out of the public eye, you have to understand that one of the reasons they're doing so is precisely to avoid a proliferation nightmare, because this is a very, very different kind of technology. You don't have the ability, in other words, to monitor the proliferation of it in a weaponized form as you do with nuclear weapons. So in other words, they are, in a certain sense, acting altruistically, and it's something that everybody needs to bear in mind. These elites, in suppressing this stuff, do have an altruistic motive, because quite literally, if you get your hands on this stuff and you're successful in developing it, as I believe the Nazis were, if you get your hands on this stuff, then yeah, you've got a potential doomsday weapon that's going to make anything in our contemporary thermonuclear arsenals look like nothing but a kitchen match.
So you would envision, for example, China or Russia potentially giving the Western world maybe a taste of some of this technology then?
I believe that what has happened is in the last 20 years, and I realize I'm throwing a lot of stuff out here, I believe that you can make a case or argue kind of a prima facie case that within the last 20 years, you have seen the emergence of weaponized versions of this technology in use, all right? Because this technology will allow you to do things like engineer earthquakes. It will allow you to do things like manipulate weather. It will allow you to do all sorts of stuff. So I believe that, you know, we need to remember after the Haiti earthquake, the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, accused the United States of using some of this earthquake technology and creating that earthquake. Well, I don't think that he's correct in where he's pointing the finger in terms of who is using it, but I do think he's correct in pointing the finger in terms of the what is being used, all right? Because we have to look at that particular earthquake and then the subsequent earthquake that occurred around Parral in Chile, which incidentally was kind of the nucleus or headquarters for one of these very large post-war neo-Nazi compounds, all right? So that ought to tell you something. You've got, I think, with those two particular earthquakes, you have the definite signatures or indicators, I should say, of a possible technology in use in both of them and, you know, shots being exchanged. I find it suspicious to this day that when Germany was reunified prior to that event, you had a series of very devastating earthquakes inside of the Soviet Union. so again, you know, we may have been looking at kind of a covert war being fought under our noses in the use and display of some of these technologies. You know, there was in 2007, there was Comet Holmes that inexplicably and suddenly exploded, you know. I think there is a possibility that you might be looking at the display of some of this technology with that event. So in other words, I think that there's some factional infighting going on right in front of our noses using some of this technology right now.
Now, are we talking HARP technology or beyond HARP?
HARP, sort of. This technology, this type of physics, is all based on the interferometry, on the interference of two or more electromagnetic beams over a particular target region to create a kind of a template of waves, a wave pattern over a particular region for whatever effect you want to produce. In other words, you configure the template in a certain way, it'll produce a certain kind of effect, all right? That research was certainly being undertaken in the Soviet Union after World War II. I suspect very strongly that it is also the conceptual basis for some of the thinking, not all of it, but for some of the thinking behind the various HARP-like arrays that you find around the world. But I think you're looking at displays and uses and tests and messages being sent back and forth by the use of this technology.
Incredible. We'll leave it there for a couple-minute break for you, and we'll see you back in a couple minutes. Sounds good?
All righty.
All right. Thank you. All right, folks. I am blown away by this interview. I wish we had another 5 hours, actually. There's an incredible amount of information. It does all go hand in hand. I am just blown away. He's bringing up these scalar weaponry hidden technology weapons, and interestingly enough, that's something I was going to, that was actually the current events that I was going to cover next. Stomp K posted, ducks suddenly die by the thousands in Canada. I want to get Dr. Farrell's opinion on all these animal bios. Is it just cold weather? You know, if we're talking scalar weaponry and scalar wars, has anyone noticed that since we've been having disagreements with China, that the East Coast, that Washington, D.C., that New York City for the last 2 years have been just slammed beyond record, or not beyond record, but record amounts of snowfall and storms, and call it El Nino if you choose to, but I think it's pretty rare. One of our members, Papa Bear, lives in Florida, the northern end of Florida, and he's getting continually slammed by these storms, and I just find it interesting. I have to wonder, the good conspirator, conspiratologist, I guess, within me says, I have to wonder if it's not weather warfare. You know, this last summer we had, what was it, Russia was burning and China was in drought? Or were they in mud rainfall, you know, being flooded? I don't remember. It's so back and forth. I think we're having weather wars, and we just touched upon that, which it does blend in to Babylon's banksters, because we're literally seeing the end game play out here. We're seeing these almost an increased pace we're seeing a definite hurried pace in this. And when we come back, which is about now, I want to ask Dr. Farrell's question, a question regarding the end game of these people. What, Dr. Farrell, are you there?
I am here. Yep. Let me add one thing to your comment about weather war. I heard some of it. I don't think, you know, don't, on the other hand, take my remarks as me stating that I believe all of these very strange weather patterns are the result of the uses of this technology, because I think that some of it is due to the fact that we're watching the magnetic pole weak, you know, the magnetic field weaken and the pole moving and so on and so forth. There are certainly possible natural explanations, but that said, the use of these technologies, I don't think the people using them are fully aware, certainly, of the results that their use is going to have on a large scale in the ecosphere. So we might be looking at natural things, but natural things that are the consequence of unnatural or technological things. So it's a very, very complex phenomenon. You know, we might be looking at a bit of both, in other words.
Now, are you a proponent of the rapid pole shift model, or do you think that this is just, we're just in an everyday portion of the cycle right now?
Well, the subject of pole shift is not something that I have studied, and it also depends on what you mean. If you mean a shift of the actual pole of rotation of the Earth, in other words, the geographic pole, no, I'm not a proponent of that. If you mean a shift of the magnetic pole, that's something very different, because clearly there is geological evidence that this is something that has happened in the past, all right? And that's a very different thing than the other kind of pole shift that some people talk about and actually get confused over. But again, even in the case of the magnetic flipping of the poles, it is not a phenomenon I have studied at any great degree or in any great depth, so I really couldn't comment other than to say that I'm aware of it and that there is scientific evidence that it has happened in the past. But again, you know, if we're playing around with these types of technologies, we could be either accelerating or damping an otherwise natural process. And again, the data, you know, is almost negligible because that kind of research is going to be classified. So it's very difficult to correlate the uses of these technologies with what we see happening on supposedly a natural plane.
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking is, and I would like your opinion on this, obviously, but, you know, we hear all this 2012 talk, you know, it's all over the place. And, you know, I take it with a grain of salt. I look at
I take it with a whole bag of salt.
Okay. All right. That's a good way. Well, but what we're seeing, though, is, for example, there's a Christian cult in the United States that dictates May 21st of this year, the rapture is going to happen. And, you know, my conspiratorial brain goes, they're going to, you know, are they going to start rounding people up on that date, you know, hauling them off to FEMA camps? You know, it seems like we're reaching a crescendo, a pinnacle of this. It seems like these banking cartels are reaching their end game. We've got, for example, it seems like there's a – I mean, it doesn't seem. It is almost blatant that there's a planned financial collapse with the derivatives and the municipal bonds. But it seems like they're being delayed for something. It seems like there's a delay in this collapse. But it seems like we're definitely in a hastened pace towards almost an endgame, you know, checkmate scenario. What are your thoughts on that? I know I went across wild, you know, across many areas there, but
well, I am in all honesty not an apocalypticist. Number one, the rapture doctrine is a doctrine unique only to a segment of Western Christianity. You know, a certain streak of fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and particularly in this country. But the doctrine itself, you know, it's that doctrine is similar, in my opinion. It's very similar to, you know, all the people within the ET UFO community that are expecting disclosure to happen any moment. You know, it's a religious expectation, and you know, I've been watching this for any number of years with my academic background in theology. You know, every year or so we get another prediction for the date of the rapture, and you know, I just don't pay any attention to them because, quite frankly, the people making these predictions are doing so on the basis of reading the tea leaves in a book and trying to correlate them to contemporary political events. I simply don't go there. As for the general culture of apocalyptic expectation and financial collapse and so on and so forth, I tend to agree with you in that I think there, if that was the plan, and I have my doubts that it was the plan, but if it was the plan, I think it has been delayed. And again, I go back to what I said earlier. I think that somebody, or perhaps some bodies, has a gun held to the Anglo-American corporate elite's head. They're not having everything go their way. And as a result of that, I think we have to look at the other part of the problem. If we put ourselves into the shoes of that particular elite, what we are looking at is an end game, yes. But as you approach the end game, each faction begins to exert its own agenda much more openly. In other words, the factional infighting as to who's going to head up this new world order only increases the closer they get to their goal. And the more it increases, the more the goal recedes. So, you know, it's a kind of a financial Zeno's paradox, if you will, because you know, the Anglo-American elite, if they think they're going to be the ones to emerge at the top of this thing and wielding the most influence, well, I think you have certain players in Moscow and Berlin and Beijing and Tokyo and New Delhi that are thinking otherwise.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I tend to be rather much more optimistic. And the reason why is in that kind of scenario, which I think you see clear signs of taking place,
sure.
In that kind of scenario, that Anglo-American elite is not going to collapse the only basis of power that they have left, which is namely North America. And by the same token, the factions with which they are in competition are not going to want to collapse that basis either, because they are too dependent on it for their own trade and for their own economic well-being. So the game has changed very dramatically, I think, in the last 8 years.
That's incredible. You know, actually, our producer Wiley, the she's the one that originally contacted you. What you just said, for the most part, is exactly what she has been saying in regards to China. We're being in the United States of America. We're almost in a fear drive where we're being
yes.
just spammed with mainstream media telling us China is going to invade and kill us. But I don't know if you're familiar with it, but are you aware that China just opened 3 banks in the United States for American people to, or I should say citizens, to invest in their yuan?
Sure, yeah, I'm aware of that. China, you know, people have to understand something about China and Chinese culture. The Chinese culture, you know, in spite of the fact that they have a communist government, the Chinese culture itself has not changed all that much. The Chinese think not in terms of the next election cycle. The Chinese think in terms of centuries, all right? They are an extremely patient people. And the leaders of their country are extremely clever. They're extremely subtle. You know, China has been going around the world in Africa and doing things like opening up schools and hospitals and building roads and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
They are playing a very, very different game geopolitically than is the Anglo-American bankster crowd in London and New York that simply want to go into these places and suck out all the resources that they can and basically leave these countries starving and friendless in the world. So, you know, China is in spite of the form of government that they have, China is making major geopolitical moves and doing so in a very clever long-term fashion. And it's important for me to say something else. China is, if you look at it in a certain point of view, from a philosophical economic point of view, China is less a communist country than it is a fascist country, because the form of socialism that they have there is what? It's national socialism, and we know what that is.
The Nazis.
Yeah,
almost.
Exactly. That's exactly what you have.
You know, now that we've kind of come full circle around, and you've mentioned Hitler a couple times.
Uh-huh.
I understand that, you know, there were 60 million or 70 million people killed in World War II. But if you really delve into the war, there are atrocities all the way around. In
yes.
your opinion,
yes.
and you know, if it's, I don't know, jaded or what have you, was Hitler trying to stand up to the New World Order?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Hitler was trying to create the New World Order. He was trying to lead it. But Hitler, it's important for people to understand that the some of the financial backers of Hitler were the same backers of the communists and the same backers of Roosevelt, all right? In other words, they're running 3 different experiments and 3 different types of socialism. When Hitler took power, he very, very quickly cut off the influence of those people over the Third Reich when he went to a form of money that was debt-free. They were called labor treasury certificates in Nazi Germany. But they were denominated in Reichsmarks. They were circulated directly by the government. They were not debt-bearing. And they were usable exactly as legal tender, all right? And as a result of this, Germany's economy, literally within a matter of a few years, turned around almost completely under the Nazi regime, because he was not borrowing money from private central banks. That's the key. And few people remember this about Nazi Germany. That extraordinarily powerful war machine was driven by an extraordinarily powerful economic machine, all right, an extraordinarily powerful fiscal machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Hitler is kind of the odd man out here, because once you put him into power and then he turns around and does this to you, if you want to keep your financial shell game going, you have to take out Germany. And I strongly suspect that, you know, the war certainly had a moral component to get rid of that hideous regime.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, it also had, from the elite's point of view, they had to get rid of that government. They had to get rid of its policies, because had it been successful, those policies would have spread and would have challenged directly that elite in New York and London.
Incredible. That is just mind-blowing. All right, a couple more questions from the mini chat. I'm going to combine this question, because it's there are two questions. I'll ask the one and then the second one that I think is part of it. With what history has shown us, what is your opinion on what we can expect during the transition from the present economy we're in now to the next? Now, to complement that, societies in the past, there have been some societies that have had debt forgiveness in times past. So I guess to fully integrate those, when do you see the Anglo-American banksters and even those in London falling? I mean, are they going to fall down? What are we going to transition to? And let's say if China comes in, which it looks like China is coming in now, are we going to see debt forgiveness? Are we going to see them potentially as a token gesture, potentially even giving us our homes back?
Well, I am not an economic or financial forecaster. My whole approach in my books has been to approach things from the standpoint of the connection between an off-the-books physics and the history and historical connections that you can trace as a result of the influence of that physics. Certainly that has a financial component. So I'm going to guess, and I want people to understand that my answer here is a guess and nothing more. But that said, I think that if there is a way out of this global financial meltdown, that at least a part of that way forward is going to have to include at least some sort of debt forgiveness. They're going to have to hit the reboot button and reset everything, all right? I think as a result of that, you're certainly going to see a diminished influence on the part of that Anglo-American corporate and banking elite. You're seeing it happen now with the massive realignments, political and economic and geopolitical, in Asia, all right? And I'm thinking particularly there in terms of China and India, Russia and Japan, all right? I don't see Japan as being any more comfortably and neatly and securely in the Western pocket as it has been since the end of World War II. I think the Japanese see their national interest and their best interest as lying in some sort of realignment with the other Asian powers. As a result of that, I think you're going to see a dramatically curtailed Anglo-American influence. I mean, my word, just look at the way that President Obama was literally read the Riot Act at the last economic summit by the Chinese premier the Chinese premier and the German chancellor, you know.
Sure.
So
yeah.
He was catching at both barrels from two sides of the world, you know. So yeah, I think you're looking at the end of this period of, you know, the robber baron financial policies that you've seen coming out of New York and London for the last century and a half. I think that's what you're looking at the end of. And if you look at it in a certain way from an even longer term historical perspective, you're looking at the final unwinding, as it were, of the British Empire. And there's going to be a massive shift of geopolitical and financial influence in the world eastward to Asia, and then, of course, that would mean China. Now, what are the Chinese going to do in terms of their influence inside this country? I can't predict at all whether this means that there are going to be fewer home foreclosures. I wish I could. I my heart goes out to those people that are facing those types of things. You know, I barely survive myself.
Mm-hmm.
So my heart does go out to these people. I think in the long term, again, I'm the eternal optimist. I'm not an apocalypticist. I think in the long term, everybody's going to be better off, but there's going to certainly be some bumps along the road, because that ilk in London and New York has been running things and influencing things for so long, and they're so used to having things their way. But by the same token, these people are so ingrown now that they can't think outside of the own conceptual box that they've put themselves into. So, you know, it's going to be a bumpy ride, because that means that their reactions to events and so on is colored and structured by a way of looking at things that's becoming increasingly obsolescent.
That's incredible. We've got about 9 minutes left. I'm going to go ahead. There's a couple more questions I want to ask straight from the chat box. This one, again, is from Tamale. He says, Dr. Farrell, I'm interested to know if you will be doing any further research into the science of cycles that you presented in your book. The argument that you allude to is essentially that we live in an open system in the grandest sense of the world, and that through subversion and obfuscation, the elite have managed to wedge us into a closed loop cycle. Do you think that this kind of system might account for the wheel of karma and related subjects?
Well, in answer to the last part of the question first, yes, I do think this kind of system does account for the wheel of karma and related subjects, because what you're dealing with is a deep physics that we are only just on the cusp of beginning to rediscover. And I emphasize the word rediscover, because all the research that I've been doing in all of my books has led me to the opinion that we are dealing with a very ancient lost civilization that had a very high and sophisticated science in which economics and physics were directly related, all right, and they understood this. So, yeah, I think with karma and astrology, things like that, you're looking at sort of the decayed legacies of a lost science, and that we're just beginning to re-understand this. As for a new cycle of openness, that's difficult to predict. However, I think basically that every elite that is contending for power and influence right now realizes, or has elements within it that realize, that there has to be some degree of openness in the system. Otherwise, it's simply going to collapse, and we're not going to move any further forward.
Incredible. That's incredible. Another question I'm being asked over and over and over again. You brought up scalar weaponry, offshoots that could be considered HARP and the such. Do you see any of that potentially being used right now? You know, there's a lot of the animals that are dying, the fish, the birds, there's a few others. People say, oh, it's just the cold weather. Do you think it's just the cold weather, or do you think it's potentially experimentation?
I do not. I think in the case of the birds and the fish, I certainly don't think that all of these animal die-offs that are being reported are the result of the test or use of some of this technology. But I do think in the case of the birds, and in some of the cases of the birds, in some of the cases of the fish, you might be seeing the signs or signatures or indicators of a test or a use of some of this technology, yes. So, yeah, that to me is a fairly clear thing.
Okay. Yeah, I was a little curious about that. Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I guess I'll ask this question quickly. The reason I was asking particularly about apocalyptic viewpoints or questions is, do you believe that the Anglo-American banksters, the Londoners, are they perpetrating a scenario to get the Christian masses to go forth and carry out the crusades against the factions that are beating them down right now? I mean, do you see that being used as a factor?
No, not really. I do think that there is an attempt to manipulate apocalyptic expectation. I do think that there is an attempt to manipulate religious perception and expectations. I mean, my word, you have only to look at the detailed documented connections I put in the Nazi International between the Nazis and radical Islam that date from prior to World War II and continued for at least a couple, if not three decades after World War II, between those two elements in the world. So, yeah, I think you have definitely a manipulation of religious expectations. As for manipulating it for some sort of apocalyptic crusade, that's anyone's guess. Again, I'm the eternal optimist. I don't think that if that's in the cards, I don't think that you're going to see the Asian powers playing along with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, again, Russia does not have, by dint of the fact that it's an Orthodox culture, it does not have the same understanding of end-time events as does Western Christianity, number one. And certainly in cultures like China and Japan, which are not Christian, you certainly have very different understandings of age transitions. So, yeah, I don't think you're going to see those powers going along with any sort of apocalyptic scenario like that.
Okay, we're at 3 minutes to the hour and the end of the show. So will you please tell us what you'll be working on next and plug your site?
I get that question a lot, and I have to be very honest and say I never answer that question. I never let people know exactly what it is I'm working on at any given time, simply out of kind of discretionary expedience, because I never talk about what I'm working on until a manuscript is actually finished and in the hands of the printer and I know what's being printed up. So I can't answer that question. I'm working on about three different things right now. All I can say is that one of them continues in the line of examining the ancient part of the story. The other of them continues an examination of the Nazi modern angle of the story. And I have a third little special project I'm working on. But my website that you asked me about is and people can get all of my books. There's a bookstore on my website, and that's www.GizaDeathStar, GizaDeathStar.com, and that's all lowercase, and there's no spaces. But all my books are there on my website.
Dr. Farrell, I've got to tell you, we're basically out of time here. I got to tell you, this is a great interview. I enjoyed talking to you immensely.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, sir. Will you potentially come back on the show in the future?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Beautiful. Well, I'll go ahead and wish you a good night, and thanks again for coming on the show. You are wonderful.
Well, thank you. Just let me know when the link is up so I can listen to it.
All right, sir. All right.
All right.
Well,
bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.